is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Happy Monday. This afternoon here in Washington, D.C., they're saying now 4 to 8 inches of snow coming. I hope to be with you live tomorrow. I expect to be. We'll see. Snowmageddon is on its way. Oh, come on. They got 6 feet of snow up in Maine. We're worried. I wanted to talk about, there's a bunch of stuff I want to get into today, including nutrition guidelines, the what's going on in Libya and how it's, you know, we've created another failed state and what that means, the possibility that ISIS and arguably Ukraine, it looks like they're cleaning that up a little bit. You know, that we could be looking at the sort of, I mean, these are the kind of things that came together that evoked world or provoked World War One and World War Two, arguably. But first, I wanted to start with something that I think most Americans don't understand, which is the right wing in Europe versus the right wing in the United States. If you were to ask most Americans, what do conservatives stand for? Right? What is the right wing all about? Just generically, presumably all over the world. What do conservatives stand for? They might say authoritarianism. That's typical of conservative regimes. The Chinese communist regime is very conservative. Rather repressive. I mean, you know, Singapore, super conservative. The Gulf states, super Saudi Arabia, super conservative. These are not bastions of liberality. They don't, you know, they don't love free speech, that kind of thing. So anyhow, they may say that. But I think that the big thing that people would assume from, you know, if you were to ask Americans what do conservatives stand for, is they would say they stand for small government. This is the result of a arguably 45-year war. I mean, a well-funded. We're talking probably multiple billions. In fact, I would say probably multiple tens of billions of dollars have been put into this effort since 1972, when it really got kicked off as a result of Lewis Powell's memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And led to Lewis Powell being put on the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon. And Lewis Powell then authoring the decision in 1976 in the Buckley case, saying that, in fact, if a billionaire or a company, well, actually, in 76, he was, if a billionaire wants to spend money to buy a politician, that's his free speech right. That somehow money is in the First Amendment. Spending money to influence politics, it's not called bribery, it's called free speech, and it's in the First Amendment. This was Lewis Powell's big contribution to the thing. And then by 2010, you know, they had not only put that on steroids, and in fact, actually in 77, a year after the Buckley case and the First National Bank versus Bilotti case, Lewis Powell again, with over Rehnquist's dissent, by the way, Lewis Powell said this applies not only to billionaires, but also to corporations. And then in Citizens United, they struck down the 1907 Tillman Act, and they struck down large chunks of several campaign finance reform acts from 1973 all the way up to, I think, 99 or 2000, McCain-Feingold, whenever that was, struck down much of all of them. And so today in the United States, conservative typically means not, yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, the authoritarians, you know, they're the ones who always want more wars. You go over to Fox News, it's all about, oh my God, be afraid, be afraid. But mostly what it means is making government weak enough that corporations and billionaires can write the rules of the game. That's what conservative means in the United States. It means, as Grover Norquist famously told Mara Liasson on NPR back 8 or 10 years ago, it means shrinking government down to the size where you can drown it in a bathtub. Now, why would you want to drown government in a bathtub? Because then the corporations and the billionaires can play uninhibited. They don't have to worry about the rabble. They don't have to worry about the average person. So most people in America assume that that's the case in Europe as well. And, you know, in the United Kingdom, there is some truth to that. It's not anywhere like it is in the United States. But in the UK, they're, you know, they, particularly the banksters, have considerable influence over the political parties. And I would argue that much of that might be because Rupert Murdoch controls so much of the media in the United Kingdom. He's got the equivalent of Fox News over there, Sky News. I believe Sky is. Maybe it's another network, whatever it is. He owns the Times of London, and he owns a bunch of the other newspapers. And, you know, that influence is not to be ignored. But let's just quickly go through some of the right-wing groups in Europe. And I think you're going to discover something astonishing. All of these groups, by the way, are rising rapidly in Europe in terms of popularity. They're rising from like 3% to 5, 6, 8, 10%, but they're rising. So we start out with the National Front. The National Front is Marie Le Pen. Her father was the guy who started it. She is now the visible face of it. They pulled 16% in the last presidential election in France. This from a great summary. It was published originally over at, I'm not sure where, iTunes. That doesn't work. Okay. In any case, it's Huffington Post. Yeah, this is a Huffington Post piece by Nick Robbins Early. Huffington Post has the worst print function on earth, so it's very difficult. I very rarely look for news on Huffington Post because I can't print their stuff out. Anyway, but this is one of them. They pulled 10 to 16% of the vote in the French presidential election. But here's the thing. Accusations of anti-Semitism and racism have always plagued the party. Basically, the right-wing National Front Party in France is all about, we don't want no more brown people in this country. We don't want no more Muslims in this country. France for white French people. I mean, that's basically what they're all about. Then you go to Greece. Mikos Lykos's Golden Dawn Party. The Golden Dawn Party actually uses a variation on the swastika as their logo. This party, widely described as a neo-Nazi party, Golden Dawn has been linked to hundreds of violence attacks against minorities. Once again, Golden Dawn doesn't care about corporations. Neither does Marie Le Pen or the size of government. They just don't want immigrants. Then we go to Flemish Interest. They're in favor of the secession of Flanders from Belgium. They're opposed to multiculturalism, and they want strict limits on immigration. Then you go to the Danish People's Party, right-wing party in Denmark. They got 13 seats out of the 179 in the last parliament. Their positions, nationalist sentiment, anti-immigration rhetoric. They view themselves as strongly nativist, and they want to restrict benefits to immigrants. In the Netherlands, Geert Wilders' Party for Freedom, fierce and vocal anti-Islam stance. And in Sweden, the Sweden Democrats, founded in 1988, it was originally a white supremacist group. And now they're pretty much still a white supremacist group. They've got about 5% of the vote. Why is it, you may ask, that none of the hard right governments in Europe are talking about shrinking the size of government? None of the hard right parties, rather than Europe, are talking about shrinking the size of government? Because that's not their shtick. Because in Europe, billionaires and big corporations find it much harder to buy government. I'll tell you why in a minute.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is just sort of the beginning of this analysis. But this is a really critical thing, and it comes back to our Supreme Court and why the United States is exceptional, shall we say. Welcome back. I'll pick up some Free Speech TV phone calls here, and then I'll continue my rant in 4 minutes as our commercial stations rejoin us. Maureen in Warren, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Maureen, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind? Tom, I watch you. My son and I adore you.
Thank you.
I called Social Security the other day, and they told me that I'm on disability. Mm-hmm. They told me that I could not go on to regular Social Security until I'm 66. I thought it was 65.
Yeah, that's you're encountering the changes that were made by Reagan in 83, I think it was, and they didn't take place until the boomers started aging out, and Reagan was long
dead. I worked in a bank for 27 years, so
wow.
I know exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And my other comment was, I think, especially John Boehner, before he appears on any show or opens up his mouth on any telecast, should take a breathalyzer first.
He would fail it. I mean, just he would fail it. According to Bob Ney, anyway, who knows John Boehner, and or knew but John Boehner, worked in, you know, side by side with him in Congress, was a Republican member of the House of Representatives for many years, from Ohio, as John Boehner is. According to Bob Ney, Boehner, you know, by 4 in the afternoon every day, Boehner is 3 sheets to the wind. My phrase, not Bob's. So.
Right. Well, I see it, and it just really irritates me every time I see the man during the last presidential speech. He wouldn't even stand up when they were praising the police and firemen.
Yeah.
And 2 months ago, ex-bartender tried to shoot him at his favorite watering hole.
Right.
So it just really irks me, and I think very so much for taking my call. I know I'm off topic, but I just had to get it out.
Okay. Yeah, the conservatives in this country are a mighty strange bunch. Maureen, thank you for the call. Joshua in Foreman, Arkansas. Hey, Joshua, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Hi. Really kind of even surprised that I got an answer. I've called several times before. I always had a topic ready to go.
Quick question, Joshua.
Man. I'm sorry. Did you make a reference to a book called Breaking the Ice?
I wrote a book called Cracking the Code. Is that what you're talking about how to talk to conservatives?
Yes, that's it. That's the one. That's why whoever took my call didn't know what I was talking about, because I didn't know what I was talking about myself.
It's Cracking the Code is the title of the book.
Okay, yeah.
And there's used copies over on Amazon for like 3 cents. I mean, it's you can buy a brand new one if you want to, but they're easy to find. And libraries have them as well. They're for free.
They're easy to find if you know the title.
There you go. Yeah, that helps. or the author's name. I mean, you can just hit one, you know, like Amazon or Barnes & Noble and plug my name in. But, yeah, the title of the book, Joshua, is Cracking the Code. And it's all about the different worldviews, the liberal and conservative worldviews. Thanks a lot for the call, Joshua. Great to hear from you. We will be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the Helping You Win the Water Cooler Wars. Okay, let me just, in fact, I think Hack has a great distillation of what I'm trying to say that he'll tell us about on the air in just a second here. But let me just state this again, set this up again. Across Europe, we have these very conservative parties, these hard right parties. Their agenda is not about elevating corporate control and billionaire control to the point where it runs the government and sets its own rules. In the United States, we used to have conservatives who were consistent with conservative principles. I mean, if you read the history of conservative thought, genuine, legitimate conservative thought, William F. Buckley conservative thought, the real conservative thought going back hundreds of years, what you find is that, you know, basically conservatives are opposed to change, or at least opposed to rapid change. They want society, as long as things are working well, keep on doing it, tinker around the edges, always be ready to back up and start over again, but just make your change slow and gradual. It's why conservatives have opposed women's rights. It's why they opposed African Americans' rights. It's why they opposed gay rights. It's why they opposed the end of slavery. It's why they opposed the, you know, total they opposed Reconstruction. You go through a whole list. It's basically, as William F. Buckley famously said, a conservative is a man who stands athwart or astride the arc of history with his hand out shouting, stop. Why then do we have people in the United States, which is virtually the entire Republican Party, and, you know, a good 10, 20, 30% of the Democratic Party, maybe more, who are taking positions that would diminish the role of government in keeping us all safe, reducing our access to health care, reducing our access to education, impoverishing us, reducing our power in the workplace, reducing our ability to protect ourselves, or at least have our government protect us, to the extent that our government is us, to protect ourselves from predators in the banking industry and the retail industry and the manufacturing industry and the pharmaceutical industry, and protecting us in terms of the safety of our food and our air and our water. Why is it that people who call themselves conservatives are opposed to these in the United States, and by and large, not so much in Europe? Here's why. Because in the United States, over the last 40-some-odd years, our Supreme Court has said it is perfectly legal for both corporations and wealthy individuals, and for that matter, foreign governments, if they launder it through the right instruments, excuse me, for them all to buy American politicians and to buy as many politicians as they want. Okay, Hack, you had a crystallization of my opening rant. Hack in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Go for it.
Absolutely. Republicans want smaller government for the same reason criminals want fewer cops.
There you go. Brilliantly said. Brilliantly said. Thank you, Hack, for that. John in Minneapolis, you wanted to contribute something?
Yeah. I just wanted to say pretty much the same thing. You know, as you eliminate government, you empower business and corporations.
And billionaires.
If you weaken any other voices and they're the only voice, then, you know, we have a very powerful corporate state, but we don't have a real democracy. It's just inherent. And, you know, the difference between us and Europe is that they have had more participation, maybe because of the parliamentary system, where they've had to deal with different parties. And as you've pointed out, in Germany, you lived in Germany, you know, they have workers who are actually on the board of corporations. They're just, it just evolved so differently since World War II as opposed to what has happened here. And I think that Americans really like, you know, they want money. I mean, I think our American dream, as opposed to the European dream, Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book about it, which I think everybody should read, is that our dream is much more materialistic. We all want to be rich, unfortunately.
Well, I would say that the American dream historically has not been, hey, I can hit the jackpot. That came along with the Reagan Revolution. Prior to the Reagan Revolution, the American dream was my dad's life, you know, that even with a high school diploma or a couple of years of college without a professional degree, you can get a job, you can raise a couple of kids, you can raise, in my dad's case, he raised four boys, you can raise a family, you can put them through school or at least help them get through school, you can retire, and in your retirement, you can have a decent life. Throughout your working years, you can take a couple of weeks.
Your own life. You know, I mean, upward mobility, that was always the thing. You know, your kids are supposed to do better than you.
Yeah.
I'm middle class. I'm about as middle class as my father was. And I feel like perhaps I'm a failure. You know, I mean, in the American way of thinking, you know, holding on to middle classness is a big mistake, unfortunately. I mean, that, you know,
we're told that
in Holland, they don't think that way. Being middle class is a tradition.
Yes.
And also, you know, I mean, because it's such a tiny country, if everybody aspired to live in, you know, really big houses, there'd be no room. You know,
I agree, John. And we've got a media, consumer driven media, and our media actually kind of went through some changes in the 80s, again, reflecting, I think, the Reagan zeitgeist, prior to the 80s, if you look at the TV shows, you had Dick Van Dyke living in a normal, you know, house in New Haven, Connecticut. You had Ricky and Lucy living in a, you know, a second floor walk up in Manhattan. You had Jackie Gleason living in a fourth floor cold water walk up in Manhattan. I mean, you had people being shown as normal middle class folks. And then suddenly in the 80s, everybody was living in these multimillion dollar homes. And it's pretty much been that way ever since. And I think that that's driving the situation too. John, thank you for the call. But the point that I was trying to make, and I want to just bring this back, make this point, we can have this conversation in the next half hour, is that in the United States, these people who call themselves conservatives but are calling for reduction in the power of government to constrain predators, whether they be corporate or just rich people, these people are not actually conservatives. They're actually radicals or revolutionaries.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And frankly, I think we need to stop calling them conservatives. So you could arguably call them fascists, radicals, revolutionaries, something, but not conservatives. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There's a few other pieces that I have to fit into this puzzle that will continue through the hours. The first, how businesses use government to create monopolies. There's actually a great piece over on the Daily Beast from last week. It's titled, A Millionaire Who Wants to Control Washington's Weed, as in State of Washington, now that it's legal there. And a New York Times piece titled Why Judges Tilt to the Right. And again, it's what it comes down to is the biggest game in town, the name of the game these days in business and politics and the way that they interact with each other is monopoly. It's, you know, locking down the marketplace, keeping everybody else out of the marketplace, having two or three, quote, competitors who all have roughly the same prices and services so that the American consumer is stuck. And then taking that, you know, market position and certifying it in law. As Henry Wallace, the Vice President of the United States, on April 9, 1944, told the New York Times, quote, he's speaking about these people that today we call conservatives. He said they claim to be super patriots. They demand free enterprise, but they're the spokesman for monopoly and vested interest. The final objective toward which all of their deceit is directed is to capture political power so that using the power of the state and the power of the marketplace and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common working man in eternal subjection. Pardon me, it's very, very cold outside, and the heat just came on, and every time the heat comes on in here, it blows dust in my face, and I sneeze. Welcome to the wonders of 70-year-old buildings. Oh, my. Paul in Woodinville, Washington.
Hi, Tom.
Oh, well, I sneeze, you talk. Go for it.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, given what you were just talking about, I don't know how anybody could argue that what we have in America today is a free market system. You know, it's take it from telecommunications to it doesn't matter which part of the economy you want to look at. It's not free market. There's no raging competition going on in any sector of our economy. And what that reminds me of, really, is, I mean, I know you were saying these aren't conservatives, but what they remind me of is the monarchical conservatives, the classical conservatives. I mean, there was commerce, and all it was the commerce, the corporations, as they were good buddies with the monarchy. And everybody else, it was small government, but there was nothing for the people. It was small government, all right.
Agreed.
The only thing the government really had was the military. And the rest of us be damned. The other thing I'd like to say is that I'm tired of this being as government being this faceless entity of I think people forget that the government is, as the Constitution begins, we the people.
Right.
So they'd like to, on the one hand, Gore Norquist would like to drown we the people in the bathtub.
Right, because we the people get in the way of the billionaires who fund Grover Norquist and the corporations. I mean, he's a very successful K Street lobbyist.
I just heard him on a show last week who was talking about how what happened in Kansas. Well, he said that happened because there was about 8 or 10 Republican senators who might as well be Democrats, and they spent like drunken sailors. I went, what? Wait a minute. They just got rid of them. So and Brownback's only had a couple of years to fix what the damage they'd done.
Right. Did they when they interviewed Grover Norquist, did they introduce him as a multimillionaire K Street lobbyist?
No, he's just a patriotic American
who's for
cutting taxes. He's a freeloader. He's and that's what all this tax cutting is. It's freeloading. What's happening to these Republican states is they've pretty much tax cut themselves into a corner because,
Bobby Jindal is leaving behind a $500 million deficit. Sam Brownback's dealing now with a $1 billion deficit. In Michigan, they've got a crisis going on. In Indiana, I mean, a lot of these right wing states, and I mean, some of it is fairly easily manufactured. Refusing to take Obamacare money, for example, in North and South Carolina is causing them all kinds of problems. They're having to close their hospitals. We had the mayor, Adam, what was his last name? Say that again. O'Neill, yeah. Adam O'Neill, who was on this show a week or so ago, the mayor of, Belhaven, I think, North Carolina.
And some of these states are going to reach the point of no return. And I think of in your home state of Michigan, where, if the infrastructure falls apart too much, there will not be, nobody will be able to raise taxes enough. And now in Michigan, because of the roads, are going to go through another winter. And they're not even going to vote on a tax bill. And what they're talking about in Michigan is voting on a 1% increase in the sales tax, which is not going over well with anyone.
Right.
And if that doesn't pass, they're going to go through another season, not just this winter, but next winter, because this doesn't come up till May. And if they don't have any money to get started on road projects during the nice weather, they're going to fall into the autumn and next winter and have still more. Last year, the roads were such a disaster. Honestly, I don't think they're safe to drive on. Last year I was there.
They're not safe at the speed limits that they have posted. 70 miles an hour, you hit some of those potholes. It's not a matter of just losing your wheel bearings. You lose control.
Yes, you do. Exactly right.
Yeah. Paul, brilliant. Thank you for your analysis, and thank you for the call. Thomas in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Thomas. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Thank you. I've noticed for the past couple of weeks, you've been a little hesitant to call conservatives fascists, at least as I like to call them, the conservators. And I was thinking for you, maybe neo-fascists would be best, because they're like a new breed.
Yeah.
They're a little bit of police state mixed in with oligarchs, and I was wondering what you thought.
Well, neo is what is it, Latin for new? I think it is.
Yes.
It's either Latin or Greek. I'm pretty sure it's Latin. And so they would be the new fascists. And I don't disagree. In fact, I did like 2 days a week ago today, I think. Maybe it was 2 weeks ago today. I did a couple of days of just total flat-out screaming rant about how these guys are fascists, quoting Henry Wallace from the 40s and going back to FDR and whatnot. But I think FDR was more correct. And while Henry Wallace called them fascists, at that point in time, of course, we didn't know the extent of the horrors of fascism in Germany. And it was more about fascism being the merger of corporate and state interests combined with belligerent nationalism. And that's real. The problem is that, and this is why I'm reluctant to use the word fascist more than occasionally for purposes of kind of dictionary, is because when you say fascist, people think Hitler. Hitler was not a fascist. He was the leader of a death cult. Mussolini was a fascist. Franco was a fascist. The guy down in Chile, Pinochet was a fascist. I think that, calling them fascist, the problem with that is that if people think you're exaggerating, they don't take you seriously. Calling them corporatists, which even is a little too soft, but basically, like, they care more about corporations and corporate health and wealth than they do about our country. Or calling them, That's a good question. What's the name? But thank you, Thomas, for the call. Neo-fascist is a good contribution to the lexicon. And I appreciate your call. Jason in Rockford, Illinois. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the call. So, I mean, I just want to play devil's advocate here for just a quick second.
Sure.
You talk a lot about the problem is that these corporations are able to buy, what we call conservative politicians.
Not just conservatives.
Well, that's exactly my point. A lot of times the liberal side of the aisle tries to act like there is no millionaire liberals. There are billionaire liberals that are buying, votes and buying politicians just the same.
Well, there's one that I know of, Tom Steyer. Who else is there?
You know more than me. I mean,
I honestly don't. I mean, I've been to Democracy Alliance meetings. I've met these guys. I don't think George Soros has put money into politics since 2009 or 2010. It's been a while. Basically, what happens is when conservative billionaires put money into politics, they buy politicians who are going to lower their taxes and who are going to reduce the cost of regulation for them, who are going to say, yeah, you can dump more poison into the air, you can put more poison in the water, it's okay. In other words, it increases their profits and increases the costs to all the rest of us when conservative billionaires invest in politicians. So they invest $100 million and make back $200 million. If Tom Steyer invests, in the last election, I think he committed $50 million. If he puts in $50 million and gets his carbon tax, he's going to lose another $50 million. He's going to see his income is going to go down rather than up. So there's not a lot of billionaires who got that way by being, acquisitive and as in wanting to acquire. Greedy might be the wrong word, but, being very, very successful businessman. Let me get this. There's not a lot of billionaires who, spent their whole life accumulating and then will turn around and say, I think I'll support a politician who wants to take this away from me. So, it is an imbalance. Therefore, the traditional supporters of Democrats have been labor unions. And that's why Ronald Reagan declared war on labor. You had a third of the American workforce unionized, and those unions were a major support of Democratic politicians in 1980, and now it's 7%. Jason, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 1:45.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more. Oh, and the Koch brothers. Are they conservative or liberal or what? More on that. Welcome back. Let's see here. Sean in Chicago watching freespeech.org. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, how you doing this evening? It's an afternoon time.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, like, with the billionaires, like, why do they let other billionaires mess with their interests? Like, take, for instance, like the jobs bill the president's been proposing. Mm-hmm. Now, for the infrastructure bill, the construction corporations will stand to benefit from that.
From the
infrastructure bill,
right. they would benefit from it, and they have lobbied for it, Sean.
Right. So why doesn't that, why didn't that pass?
Because the construction corporations don't own the kind of lobbying apparatus in this town that the billionaires do. The construction corporations, to the extent that there are a few really large ones like Bechtel, which is entirely privately held, much, if not most of what they do is offshore, it's overseas. So a lot of these construction corporations, they're getting government contracts to rebuild Afghanistan or build something in some other country, which kind of keeps them happy. But the really big money in this town is coming out of the banking industry and out of the pharmaceutical industry. That's where the really big money is. And those industries want less regulation, which means they want hard right Republican representation. Or they want, in the case of the banking industry, they want Democrats who will not prosecute them, which is what they've gotten over the last six years with the Obama administration. Not one bankster has been prosecuted for anything.
So technically,
yeah. So anyhow, Sean, thanks a lot for the call. Russell in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Russell.
Hey, How you doing, Tom?
Good. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV.
Yeah, I had initially called to ask a different question, but now after listening to you, here's one question I have: is would if the Supreme Court destroys Obamacare, as it's referred to, the Affordable Health Care Act,
right,
would that open the door for single payer?
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, if the Supreme Court actually took all this apart, if they succeeded in this case that's coming along here, if the Supreme Court took them down, thank you, then you know it's entirely possible. But it's hard to know. It's so much depends on what we the people do, Russell. It's a matter of people need to, you know, participate. This is what Bernie Sanders is struggling with right now. Struggling is the wrong word. Trying to figure out right now is there enough of a base of support for a populist candidate? Are there enough people who are going to say, yes, I'll get out there and do something? Or is it going to be, you know, a couple of corporatist candidates on the Democratic and Republican side? And if so, is that going to stand? Is that what's going to play out?
So. Okay, well, one other question also is, how do you think the Republicans will play this off as a job killer, single payer? I mean, the Affordable Care Act was a job killer. So how do you think they'll play off single payer? Thank you for answering my call.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling, Russell. Single payer will kill off some jobs over the short term. There's lots and lots of people in the health insurance industry who have the job of keeping track of you and trying to cut your benefits or, you know, figure out slick ways or skimming money off the top. So if we did away with the health insurance companies, there would be some jobs lost. On the other hand, there'd be such a boost to the American economy that they would easily find other jobs. Russell, thank you for the call. We'll be back. In the next hour, I want to get into why this piece that was on Think Progress. No, the Koch brothers are not socially liberal. I'll kind of give you the punchline right now because it's just the final wrap up of this whole rant that I've been going through today. And that is that, you know, David and Charles Koch have been doing these interviews in the media lately where they've been saying things like, you know, I'm economically conservative, but socially I'm a liberal. I support gay marriage. I support decriminalization of pot. I'm all in favor of abortion. But the reality is that they put their money to candidates who don't support those things. Now, why would they support those things but put their money to candidates that don't support those things? Because their real agenda is economic. Their real agenda is about protecting their industries. Anyhow, it's President's Day today, by the way. It's and as such, I wanted to bring in Professor Harvey Kay, Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay, author of numerous books. The latest, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. His website, twitter.com/HarveyJK, J-K-A-Y-E. Hey, Harvey.
Tom, good to hear your voice.
Back at you, Professor.
On the phone as opposed to on the air alone.
There you go. You said you have a story for us about Newt Gingrich, the National Mall, and the presidential monuments?
Yeah, it's just a segue into presidents. About 10 years ago, my younger daughter was interning for Senator Russ Feingold at the U.S. Senate, and she called and said that she had just come from a lecture that all the interns were encouraged to attend by Newt Gingrich. And Gingrich had told them all that he had walked the mall some evening in D.C., obviously, and said that he discovered the presence of God on the mall, that, you know, that America was this, you know, godly nation. And I said to my daughter, well, that's fascinating. We can all see the mall as we wish, but I don't quite know what to say. But I kept thinking about it. And then, if I could just show, a few years later, he brought out this little book. I don't know if it's on the air there or in your studio.
Yeah, it's God in America.
God in America. Yeah. And it's basically a walking tour of the national monuments. And I have to tell you that I'm always amazed by how conservatives can lay claim to both history, you know, time and space, which isn't really theirs. So, you know, I have been thinking for quite some time about when I walk the national monuments, ever since I was a child, in fact, what I find there is this sort of democratic narrative, but a narrative that I'm not so sure that we all think about when we go to the mall. So I wanted to say that on President's Day, for those of, well, I know today's not a good day to go walking around anywhere in much of the country, but when people go to Washington, They really ought to think about the National Mall in terms of being this grand narrative of American life and just how progressive the narrative is down there on the Mall. You've got the Revolutionary General. You've got the author of the Declaration of Independence. You have, you know, the president who led us through a civil war and signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And you've got the president who creates with, you know, millions of Americans the New Deal and then goes off and fights fascism in World War II. And then, of course, you know, additionally, Martin Luther King and other monuments. I mean, it's just truly a narrative of democratic struggle and, in fact, democratic progress for all of the tragedies and ironies in American life. And I'd like people to think about that on President's Day and you know, think about just the kind of history that we progressives have to assert in favor of a more progressive future.
I'm curious. I've been reading Henry Wallace's works on the air now for a few weeks. For a few years, actually, but I mean pretty aggressively the last few weeks, particularly his article April 9th, 44 in the New York Times, where the Times editorial board asked him if there were fascists in America, who they were and what we needed to do about them. And he basically said that the fascists in America were the ones who were reaching out for control over government because they already controlled the marketplace. He went back to FDR's economic royalist meme. I've been arguing on the air that the word fascist is not a reasonable word for Americans to use to describe these guys, because everybody thinks of Nazis when you say that, and it just distracts from the argument. People have suggested neo-fascists. There's FDR's economic royalists. In my book, The Crash of 2016, I used economic royalists fairly heavily. Do you see any new terms? I mean, robber barons is the old one. What's emerging? What do we call these guys?
Well, I know that a lot of folks have been calling them plutocrats.
Oh, plutocrats is a good one.
I mean, I like that one. I love the economic royalist reference because that conjures up this sort of American radical tradition that goes back to the Revolution.
Right.
So I like that a great deal. The plutocrats, of course, conjures up the image of the, you know, the fat cats of the Gilded Age, as they would say. So, I'm a fan of Franklin Roosevelt and love the American Revolution so much. I like economic royalists, but plutocrats has a kind of punch to it.
Well, you're a professor of democracy studies. What would you call? I'm asserting here that modern day conservatives are not really conservatives, because conservatives are in favor of small incremental change in society, and these people are calling for a radical reconstruction of society. Now, granted, it's a radical re or deconstruction of a fairly radical forward construction that happened back in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. But still, I'm suggesting that they're radicals. Would you correct me, sir, if I submitted that as a paper to your class?
Well, I would talk to you, Tom. I say, you know, Tom, I like the spirit in which you're writing this, but I hate the fact that we now use the term radical, which is a great democratic concept, to refer to folks on the right. And I regret the fact that somewhere along the way we lost the term reactionaries.
That's the word. Yes.
You know, so that would be. I wouldn't downgrade you a bit. In fact, I'd praise you for your inventiveness. But I would.
But I should be using the word reactionary rather than the word radical.
Yeah. Although, in fact, you know, the fact that you get the Kochs, as you were just saying on air, who are saying, well, you know, we're not really reactionaries. You know, we support gay marriage and so on and so forth. It's just, we want to destroy labor unions and cut government down tremendously in size. And of course, maybe Rand Paul would like to think about that, and maybe they would like to promote his campaign.
Yeah. Well, there's this freak show going on on the Republican side that is, I think, increasingly not being taken seriously by Americans, unlike 4 years ago. But reactionary.
Yeah, so we went from the circus of 4 years ago to the freak show of today, right?
It really is sad. And, you know, these recycled wannabes who have no chance and they're outside the mainstream, and yet they're getting, you know, the Huckabees and the...
Incredible.
Professor Harvey Kay, Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies. You want to read one of the very best books on the founding of America, read Harvey Kay's book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. His most recent book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Harvey, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Always good talking to you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. We're talking about the Reich. What's going on with the Reich in the United States? From Hay Radio across this country, every city in America. I mean, literally, all 200 and some odd major metro markets in the United States have right-wing talk radio, hate radio. Fox so-called news. Now, here's you know, this field guy's guide to Italy's, or excuse me, to Europe's right-wing parties. All the right-wing parties of Europe are basically, in fact, I had this experience when we were in Denmark. We were broadcasting from Copenhagen. Yeah, Copenhagen's the capital of Denmark. From Danish radio. DR loaned us studios for a week. And Louise and I were over there doing our show from there. And we met with Americans living there. And we had a great time. And as I have a preference for doing, I wanted to get some of the hardcore right-wing politicians on. And I got on the newspaper editor of the most seriously considered right-wing publication in Denmark. And I think it was the guy who had published the Muhammad cartoons. And I asked these right-wingers, I said, you know, what makes you a right-winger here in Denmark? And they're like, we don't want any more Muslims in this country. We're not sure we're happy with the ones who are here, and we don't want any more immigrants. And I said, well, in the United States, being a right-winger means that you're opposed to a national health care system. And I remember this one member of the Danish parliament that I had on, who was one of the leaders of the conservatives in the Danish parliament. As I recall, I mean, you go back and find the archives of the show saying, but I remember the look on his face when I said that. It was either that or when I said, you know, in the United States, half of all bankruptcies are caused by somebody getting sick. He just had this astonished look on his face. He's like, really? I'm like, yeah, to be a conservative in the United States means that you hate national health insurance, that you think people should just be on their own. And he's like, that's crazy. And I said, so that's not right wing here in Denmark. No. Well, you know, in the United States, the right wingers think that companies should be able to voluntarily follow regulations with regard to pollution or even just come up with their own. After all, they've got their own scientists. The government should not be determining how much pollution a company can or cannot dump into the air and water and soil of all the rest of us. And he's like, what, are you nuts? I'm like, that's not conservative in Denmark? No. In America, you know, the conservatives say that we should reduce the size of government to the point where something. I mean, they never say exactly what the point is. They want it lean and fit and all that kind of stuff. But what does that mean? And, you know, I said, you know, I think what it means is they want to reduce the size of government to the point where it's not an annoyance to the billionaires and to the big corporations that want to pollute our air and our water and want to move our jobs to China and want to pay us crap wages and want to prevent us from unionizing and want to, you know, et cetera. You know, who just want to basically steal from the middle class. And the conservatives in Europe will say to you, what are you talking about? Now, with the exception of the U.K., you know, the conservatives in the United States, the conservatives in the United Kingdom are very, very similar because Maggie Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were inflicted on these two countries at about the same time by pretty much the same forces. But the rest of Europe, no, not so much. So Josh Israel posted this piece last week, February 10th, over on Think Progress, about the Koch brothers, and he was they're doing some greenwashing, bluewashing, I don't know what you call it. We're friendly, bluewashing, I guess. David Koch, in an interview last December, 3 months ago, he said, and I quote, "Basically, I'm basically a libertarian. I'm a conservative on economic matters, and I'm a social liberal." Really? So, let's say same-sex marriage. Are you in favor of same-sex? Well, he's socially liberal. He's fine with same-sex marriage. So, where does his money go? Of the 265 federal elected officials who benefited from Koch-tied money, according to this article in Think Progress. Now, keep in mind, there are only 535. Yeah, there's 435 members of the House of Representatives. There's 100 members of the Senate, and then arguably the Vice President, you know, who can play the tie-breaking role in the Senate. So 535. There's 535 elected officials. 265 of them got money from the Koch brothers. That right off the top of the head, you know. Bang, that should be a what? This is a democracy? But anyhow, of those 265 federal officials who got Koch money, 253 of them were opposed to gay marriage, to marriage equality. Only 12 were in favor of gay marriage. They gave $27 million that we know of to those candidates who were opposed to gay marriage. They gave $400,000 to those officials for gay marriage. Or reproductive rights. Right to choose, right to life, right? Or whatever you want to call it. Are you in favor of a woman being able to choose to have an abortion, or are you in favor of the state saying to that woman, no, you may not have an abortion? They say they're liberal on this issue. Apparently, you know, if I'm to understand this article correctly. Well, they spent $90,000 supporting 9 abortion rights supporters, $10,000 per supporter, roughly. But of the 256 federal elected officials who got money from the Koch brothers, of the 265 that got money, 256 of them got $27 million, and they opposed abortion rights. So what's going on here is we have, and it goes on and on. I mean, you can go through issue after issue after issue. What the Koch brothers are funding are hard right candidates who want the government to be big enough to get into your bedroom, who want the government to be big enough to get into a woman's uterus, who want the government to be big enough to you know, basically regulate our lives, to say who can and can't get married. Who, you know, when can a person die? All those kinds of issues. But that doesn't matter. I mean, even if the and I take them at their word that David and Charles Koch are libertarians, that they think that these really are not the proper role of government. But mostly they think that the proper role of government is not to bother them. It's not to take any of their income in the form of taxes. It's not to tell them how much pollution Georgia Pacific can dump in the waters, or how much pollution Koch Industries can pump into the air, or how much carbon they can get out of the ground and what they should pay for it. That's really the agenda. It's an economic agenda. And it's not just the Koch brothers, as I said. Although they're, you know, when two brothers, the second richest family in America, are talking about raising and spending in the neighborhood of $1 billion in a presidential year, you have to ask yourself, is America a democracy any longer? Could it be that the Koch brothers are actually secret liberals and they're doing this just to cause everybody to go, oh, my God, this isn't democracy? So that a groundswell of support for rolling back Citizens United will happen? Could it be? I don't think so. I think they really think that Americans are that dumb, particularly, quote, conservative Republican Americans. They really believe that they can get people to vote for their economic interests by pitching them things like God, guns, gays, and grits. Right? That's to mangle Huckabee's book title. Apparently, in my opinion. What do you think?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more on this right after. This is fascinating, too, in the New York Times. We'll get to that in just a moment. But let's pick up some calls here. Terry in Bradford, Tennessee. Hey, Terry, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How you doing, Terry?
I'm doing pretty good. Hope your sneezing goes away.
It will eventually.
Corporations are people, too. I'm going to make a couple comments and bring some up for discussion, but I'd seen a judgment come down a couple months ago about punishing a corporation, and the court said you can't put the people in jail because there's so many involved in a corporation. So they're only people when it comes time to donating money for politics, but when it comes time to criminal liability, you can't put a corporation in jail.
Right.
Number two, Bush's original tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Bill Gates, as well as the oil companies back in W's tax cut days. Bill Gates said, I have nothing I can invest my money in that can create more jobs than what I'm doing already. So he was buying back his stock. The oil companies back in that day were buying back their stock, like 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And anyways, let's get to the conservative thing.
Terry, do you know why these companies do stock buybacks?
Increases the value.
Well, it increases the value of the stock options owned by the senior executives. That's and the stockholders, too, in general. It doesn't actually increase the value. What it does is it increases the price. If there's 1 million shares of stock out there and they're valued at $1 a share, the company's worth $1 million. If you take that 1 million shares of stock and reduce it down to only 500,000 shares of stock by buying back half of them and then retiring them, you still have $1 million company, but each share of stock is now worth $2 because there's only 500,000 shares of stock. So if you're an executive with that company and you had been given the option to buy 100,000 shares of stock at $1, what you do when you what's called exercise the optional, when you want to take the money out, you wait until the price goes up. So instead of waiting until the price goes up, you make the price go up. You buy back, if you bought back half that stock, the price of the stock price would double. Even though there's not a penny of increased value anywhere, the company hasn't made or sold anything that's making anybody rich. This is purely the manipulation of stock. But the executive who's sitting on $100,000 worth of stock is now all of a sudden sitting on $200,000 of stock. And because when you cash in stock and you put that money in your pocket, you only pay capital gains tax, he's looking at a maximum 15 or 20% tax rather than the 39% tax that, the workers on the assembly line could be facing if any of them ever accumulate enough overtime if they're in the top bracket. Am I making sense, Terry?
All right, well, therefore, we have no job growth because there's no investment.
That's exactly right.
In the company itself, which is what the original tax cuts was for, was to spur the economy and create job growth, which it did not.
Yeah, it wasn't to do that, Terry. It was to give money to the guys who donated to Bush's campaign.
Well, basically the same thing to me.
Yeah.
You're conservative liberal. My question is, would you consider China conservative or liberal?
Conservative.
Right.
China is very conservative. They've got morality police running around. They're shutting down porn sites. They're throwing people in jail for speaking out against the government. They don't allow freedom of speech. They're telling women how many babies they can have. They're extremely conservative. Terry, thank you for the call. 20 minutes, and so is ISIS, for that matter. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past three. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour, Tom. I've been here with you. New York Times article, this was in the Sunday Review 2 weeks ago. I printed it out, and I just never got to it. I got this long, large stack of things that I've printed out I want to share with you, I want to talk about, but sometimes the days get away from us. It's by Adam Liptak. It's titled, Why Judges Tilt to the Right. And he points out that the majority of lawyers in the United States are actually liberal. And the reason why, I mean, the majority of college graduates in the United States are liberal. The majority of college students are liberal. The majority of college professors are liberal. The majority of news reporters are liberal. Why? Because facts tend to be liberal. I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. If you think that conservative means that you're in favor of teaching that the world is 6,000 years old and the global warming doesn't exist, if that's what conservative means, it's counterfactual. The facts are liberal. If you think that conservative means the kind of billionaire Koch Industries definition of conservative, I guess, that government should not be taxing billionaires and at least in any consequential way, and should let corporations do whatever the hell they want. Let them make the rules of the games of the economy. If you think that that's conservative, you know, most thinking people have figured out by now that that's just a scam that the billionaires are running on us and that the big corporations are running on us. So why is it that most judges are conservatives? The study came out of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Maya Sen was a political scientist who put it together, and she said, politics plays a really significant role in shaping our judicial system. So our judicial system, the third branch of government, we have a three-branch government as established by our Constitution. Article 1 establishes the legislative branch. Article 2 establishes the executive branch, the presidency. And Article 3 establishes the judicial branch, the Supreme Court and all the inferior courts, all the federal courts and whatnot. And the authors argue that a court is politicized. Well, here it is. This is very, judges are more conservative than the average lawyer. Why? The answer the study says is the judicial selection processes are affected by politics. In many states, you elect judges. As Ruth Bader Ginsburg pointed out last week, I think she said it was in 29 states judges are elected, or at least Supreme Court state judges are elected, and there's millions of dollars that go into that because those judges now have the power. Keep in mind, more than half of all the activity that goes through our court system, which you and I pay for with our taxes, more than half of all the activity that goes through our court system is one corporation suing another corporation. It's corporate law. It's the majority of what goes through our court system. Yes, there's a lot of people who are being prosecuted. A lot of people go to prison in the United States. But there's still more, there's more expense for our court system because of corporate activity than not. And so if you're a corporation and you know that there's a good chance you're going to end up before a judge at some point, wouldn't it be a good idea to do everything you can to make sure that that judge is a pro-corporate judge, a, quote, conservative? Now, as I pointed out, only in the United States is that really the definition of conservative. But that's where we're going. Couple other things I wanted to quickly share with you here, and we can continue the conversation throughout the day. Did you hear this? In Egypt, the ISIS, ISIL, whatever you want to call it, the Islamic State, executed a bunch of Egyptian Christians. Egypt, Mr. al-Sisi, I believe, is the new president, the new prime minister. Yeah, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. He's not happy with this, and ISIS has moved into Libya. We used a drone strike to take out Muammar Gaddafi and basically decapitated Libya. It has devolved into a failed state, as has Iraq, as has Afghanistan. As you know, and Syria is moving in that direction. Huge foreign policy blunder on our part. And now, because these Egyptian Christians were executed by ISIS, and they put it up, you know, they put the video up on YouTube and said, ha ha, here we go, ta-da, we are barbarians. The Egyptians are now bombing ISIS in Libya. So the Libyan government, in fact, has been run out of Tripoli. ISIS is taking control of Tripoli, as I recall, and at large swaths of Libya, in any case. And there's multiple factions that are fighting against each other, although more and more people are saying, oh, yeah, we'll just join up with the Islamic State. This is looking to me, if you look back at World War One and World War Two, for that matter. They started out in arguably multiple places, although there were, from the United States' point of view, there were these ignition points, right? The assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in, what was it, 1917 in Sarajevo, and the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which was December 5th, 1941, as I recall. And so we say, well, these were the starting points, but really there were multiple starting points, which is why we ended up with a war, you know, with a front in the Pacific and a front in the Atlantic, and World War One was happening all over, not just Europe, but Central Asia and Northern Africa. If you look at the situation in the Ukraine and the situation in the Middle East and the situation in Northern Africa, all of these things, I think, have the potential to be the next world war, which concerns me tremendously. A fellow in the Council of Foreign Relations, Micah Zenko, tweeted yesterday. He said, ISIS, created in an Iraq destabilized by U.S.-led regime change, now entrenched in Libya, destabilized by U.S.-led regime change. When will we ever learn?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Cue the Peter, Paul, and Mary song. We'll be right back with your calls and my thoughts on a couple other. Oh, I got to tell you about the Sons of the American Revolution. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you as we speak. Maybe it was a little earlier in the day, actually, although the Guardian says it's live. Eurozone ministers holding crunch talks. They're trying to figure out what to do about Greece. This is really interesting. We're seeing an actual revolt here. Greece, you know, back to conservatives, and what are conservatives and who are they and what do they have to say? The corporatist conservatives have taken over the European Union, and most of them are centered in Germany and France, and are tight with the banksters. And they're basically saying to Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal and any country that wasn't a net generator of wealth for the EU, what they're saying to these countries is, you have to keep paying us back. You have to keep doing things our way. You have to cut back on your social safety network. We're not going to cut back on Germany's or France's, but you've got to cut back on yours. And I think this is going to stretch until the point it breaks. And when it does, you're going to see. I believe the best thing for Greece would be to go back to the drachma and do it tomorrow morning. But probably it's going to happen in the next few weeks, if it happens. Because the Europeans are talking about, well, we'll give you $5 billion if you'll just stay in the EU and keep using the euro. And most Greek people want to continue using the euro. They think that this makes Greece, you know, part of the big boys club. But a lot of Greeks are figuring out how badly screwed they've been by the so-called conservatives, the corporatists in Europe. Zeph in New Orleans. Hey, Zeph, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
You just said it. The reason I called, but I'd like to make another comment. But the reason I did call was when I first looked up the word fascism back in the early 90s, because I was interested in, I realized Mussolini's own definition of his own philosophy used the word corporate state, corporatism, almost 3-4 times in the first two paragraphs of defining his own philosophy.
Correct.
And then I saw Ralph Nader on TV a few years later saying what these Republican conservatives really are corporatists. So I don't like to take out the word fascist because I think it's powerful to shock your opponents into listening to what you have to say. And you have to have a little bit of venom after all the dirty tricks they've pulled. So I like to call them corporate fascists whenever I email my friends and explain to them. And the way they demonize liberalism, you just nailed it too. I like to say facts and the truth are liberal. Jesus is a liberal. And the Constitution of the United States is liberal. And the Declaration of Independence is a liberal document. It sets their hair on fire. They don't know where to go with that. And they cannot dispute it.
It's all true.
So, but on Meet the Press, this Sunday, they brought up one of the great advantages of your show, which I don't think you realize for some reason. They they are saying they were touting all the conservative success on talk radio, and they put down the liberals on talk radio as not being effective enough. Tom, you got to go and meet the press. You got to put them in touch with what you do.
See, that's the thing. They won't have me. It's the I don't know if you saw one of the stories I was going to get to is it's right here. Sun News Network. You ever heard of the Sun News Network, Zeph?
I'm sorry, I haven't.
The Sun News Network in Canada is what we call Fox News here in the United States. It is a right-wing news network that was put together by a bunch of ideological right-wingers, funded by ideological right-wingers and businesses. And
corporate fascist news network.
Yeah, well, you know, they want it was just going to be the Fox News for Canada. And they rolled this thing out back in 2008, and they went off the air Friday night Friday morning at 5 a.m. Eastern time. And the reason they went off the air is while the network was available to 5.1 million households through cable systems, on average it was only attracting 8,000 viewers at any given time. We're doing a lot better than that. According to Talkers Magazine, we're drawing around 3 million. I think that number might be a little high, but not all that insanely high. But the fact of the matter is that, and I've been saying this for a long time, and I know this from personal experience, it's not just the message, it's also the platform. We were, you know, this show, you know, back when I was on Air America, we were on, for example, a station in Miami, Florida. We were pulling 4.7 shares. That means 4.7% of all the people listening to the radio in Miami were listening to our show. In the city of Miami, typically one share point is worth $1 million in advertising revenue. So we were making $4.7 million a year for that radio station, arguably, right? According to that logic. The company that owned that station was owned by Mitt Romney. They took Air America off that station and replaced it with sports. The sports on that station has never broken a one share since then. But, hey, they don't have any more liberal programming in Miami. So there's, I mean, you know, as a result of the Telecommunications Act that Bill Clinton signed in 96 and a series of deregulatory measures starting in 87 with Ronald Reagan, what we have seen is this massive consolidation of media in the United States. And one of the things that made Fox News so successful was that Rupert Murdoch was willing to lose $500 million over a 5-year period. He lost $100 million a year for 5 years. To create Fox News. Before Sean Hannity made his first penny, he had lost $500 million. And Air America lost $16 million, and they ended up declaring bankruptcy. They couldn't get any more money. Their biggest sin was that they were underfunded and that they were that they came into the American media landscape at a time when all the large stations had been bought up by two or three very, very large, very, very conservative right-wing corporations that were more or less privately owned. And so, you know, that's the real story, frankly, behind. You know, go ahead.
Thank you. First of all, two things. Bill Clinton apologized for that Telecommunications Act. You can ask Randy Rhodes. Second of all, Bill Maher is on a new campaign now to say that liberalism is patriotic. What a beautiful concept. We don't have to take it anymore. Liberalism is patriotic. The Constitution is liberal. The Declaration is liberal. And Jesus was liberal. And talk radio is liberal. And we're patriotic. We don't have to take it anymore. We shouldn't back off from the word fascism. Call them what they are, corporate fascists.
I'm with you. Zeph, well said. Thanks a lot for the call. Lance in Harvey, Louisiana. Hey, Lance, what's up?
How you doing?
Good.
First of all, happy Mardi Gras. Get it off to you.
Well, thank you. Is Mardi Gras going on in New Orleans now? Or in Louisiana?
Right now, this is the big weekend. Tomorrow is Fat Tuesday. But now, I was up to talk about a great governor. You talked about him last week about his medical, cutting medical stuff here, and how he put us in debt.
Bobby Jindal.
The main reason we're in debt is because of this brand new hospital he's building in New Orleans. Instead of rebuilding the old charity hospital, while renovating it after Katrina, it would have cost us $500 million to redo that building and put everything that he's putting in the new building into that building. And the new building is going to cost us over $1 billion.
Whoa.
Tell you how smart he is, right? Yeah, brilliant guy. I think the reason why he did that was because several reasons. First, land grab. He had to buy up the neighborhood that they put the new hospital in. So him and his buddies bought the land up and sold it back to the state for a very big profit. And also, I think he wants to put his name on it so that he could say, here, New Orleans, see what I built for y'all? So y'all can start voting Republican.
Yeah.
you know, and yeah. stuff like that. And he's just ridiculous. The guy is crazy. Do you know about how he held, well, him and the owner of the Saints held the city and the state hostage for a couple months after Katrina?
No.
Well, the owner of the Saints would not negotiate with the former governor, Kathleen Blanco, until she got out of office.
She was a Democrat.
With the state. Yeah. She didn't run this time because she was sick. She had some kind of cancer in her throat or something. But he raided to make sure that his boy, Bobby Jindal, got elected to the governorship before he decided to negotiate. He kept threatening to take the Saints to San Antonio. But the NFL was like, you ain't going nowhere, dude. You're not taking them nowhere. But as one big corporation y'all keep overlooking that we need to put a, I don't want to say a stop to, but regulate them, that is the NFL.
Okay, oh, yeah.
The NFL is holding these.
They've got an antitrust exemption. They've got, they're nonprofit. We're subsidizing them. You and I are paying taxes to subsidize the NFL. It's insane. I'm with you. Lance, thanks for the heads up on Bobby Jindal. I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Carl in Chicago. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Happy Monday. How are you?
Thank you. Great. Happy President's Day.
I was going to, I called on another subject, but you brought something up, and I want to thank you for bringing it up as far as the stock buyback program was going on. I've been following that for the last couple of years and talking to a major mutual fund company at night. You can call in and talk to their advisors and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you hit it right on the head as far as what they're doing with the stock buybacks for their stock options. And it makes it extremely profitable, especially in the light that 10,000 people a day are turning 65. I heard that the other day, people are getting older, the baby boomers.
Right.
But there was one other facet of that thing that I thought was interesting, and I talked to a fairly knowledgeable radio personality. I won't say what his name is. But the other thing that they're doing when they do those stock buybacks, it inflates the share price of their stock, and now these companies have shifted into like a kind of a end game, kind of a final mode. It helps them when they do mergers and acquisitions because they use cash and stock
right.
to do the mergers and acquisitions. And when they inflate the price of their stock, it makes it easier to do these mergers.
Right. And when the M&A activity happens, the executives take another big bonus off the top.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. That's big money when in mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah.
But of course, like you're saying, it's just these financial gurus, these gymnasts that did the
right. There's no wealth of nations being created here, Carl. You know, that's your point, I'm guessing, right?
Well, no, I wanted to talk about Germany.
Ah, we're out of time, Carl. You're gonna have to call back again. I'm sorry, but we're just flat out of time. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I guess the lesson of that is it's always good to start with your main point and then work down. I don't know. I'm sorry, Carl. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Bob in Arlington, Washington. Hey, Bob, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind?
Well, the revolution in 3D printing manufacturing, because it's a very democratizing technology because it distributes production to local levels. And I'm hoping it goes a lot farther than it has, because this is the only thing I see that stands up against these monopolies, is the fact that they can be undercut by these local facilities.
You know, there's a variation on that argument, Bob, that was being made back in the 1980s, as I recall. I was running, trying to remember which business I was running. I'm pretty sure it was when we were living in Atlanta in the early 80s and we were running the travel agency. And that was copy machines. Copy machines, I mean, literally the salespeople would come to your door, usually it was a salesman, a guy, but, you know, sometimes they were women. They would come to your door and try to lease copy machines to you. And Louise was running the travel agency, and she was so excited every time one of these guys would come to the door, because we'd found out creative ways to throw them out. But there was this big sturm and drang about copy machines are getting so cheap, and it's so cheap to make copies that the book publishers are going to go out of business. And companies came along in the later 80s using those copy machines and started copy centers. There was a whole bunch of different chains where literally they could publish a book. But books are still around. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that 3D printing is going to be a revolution for anybody other than big companies. That's my point.
Well, I follow it as closely as I can, and they have been a revolution in that they're quite innovative. And the important point about 3D printing is that on average it uses about 30% less resources for the same product.
Because you're not shipping it, you're not transporting it, you're not packaging it, you're not all that kind of stuff?
Because the manufacturing, because it's additive manufacturing, so that they're, you know, building it up layer by layer, so they're only using the base material of the product instead of, like, taking a block of steel and machining it down to your product.
Right. Yeah. So the problem is, Bob, that the machines, the 3D printers that can use multiple materials and print in really complex ways are mind-bogglingly expensive, the ones that they use to make.
Yes, they are.
You know,
they're getting, some of them are getting cheaper, but yes, they are mind-boggling expensive.
Yeah. So that's not democratizing. That's just a technology step forward.
Well, I hope it does wind up in a more distributed manufacturing.
Yeah. I think, you know, if it does, it's going to be really interesting to watch. I mean, you go back and look at the influence of the cotton gin. The cotton gin was introduced in the 1820s, 1830s, thereabouts. And what it, one cotton gin, and this was the beginning of the steam revolution, they were steam powered. Eli Whitney held a patent on those things. And one cotton gin could do the work of 50 slaves. And there's a fairly thoughtful body of academic work that suggests that one of the things that brought about the Civil War and the collapse and end of slavery wasn't that America got enlightened, but the cotton gin rendered a lot of slaves unnecessary. But I don't know. Bob, maybe the printer will do the same thing with other work. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. And Jason in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jason, ready for the snow?
How you doing?
Great.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. You know, you keep bringing up this HSBC thing. You know, all I'm reminded of is one of the most incompetent attorney generals ever, Eric Holder, couldn't find a single guy to put in jail on this.
Yeah.
It's interesting how a lot of more of this stuff is coming out after this guy has exited.
I don't think that's incompetence. I think Eric Holder has been a very competent attorney general. I think that's a matter of values and I mean, you know, the things that he's chosen to do, he's done very well. It's just he's choosing not to put bankers in jail. And that's an extension of policies that were established arguably back in the 90s. But, you know, aggressively and during the Bush administration.
How do you tie this to the Bush administration?
Well,
I mean,
because
Eric Holder and Obama are the presidents.
The reason I tie it to the Bush administration, Jason, is because it was during the Bush administration that a lot of the deregulation of the banking happened. It was during the Bush administration that the giant derivative bubble inflated. It was during the Bush administration that the housing bubble based on liar loans inflated, something that had been illegal before that second deregulation of the banking.
So everybody were a bunch of chumps to elect Obama to clean up Wall Street, because the fact of the matter is he doesn't do it.
I agree.
But my point is there were two bailouts of
the banks during the Bush administration. Obama did the third bailout. People think that Obama bailed out the banks. No, George W. Bush bailed out the banks twice. Remember the two tarps?
Look, I'm not arguing with you on that particular point. The point of the matter is the person at the attorney general is responsible for implementing the law.
Right.
And he violated that.
I agree.
Not just the big way, you know.
I agree.
And again, we keep having this pass. And then you go back to TARP. You know, this is the interesting thing. The story about TARP was the fact that the bad banks were forcing the good banks to take the money, because nobody wants to know that Bank of America and the HSBCs and stuff of the world were effectively insolvent. And a number of years, I think it was like less than a year ago, you tried to tie John Allison into this. John Allison of BB&T was one of the first people to say, I don't want your money. I don't want to have anything to do with it. I don't want to participate in this. And you were railing against him as if somehow him supporting David Brat was some sort of banker's conspiracy. If anything, Allison should be hailed because this is a guy that actually was in favor of a real true free market without bailouts.
Hang on,
remember
a second.
You railing
you
against
have to
him?
Talk a lot louder.
Remember him railing against Allison?
Yeah. No, I don't.
You were trying to make some sort of connection, like David Brat was getting money from John Allison.
Yeah, I'd have to.
Bankster tie-in. It wasn't. Brat was actually for more of an open favor of free markets with banking with no bailouts.
Okay. Jason, you have presumably corrected the record. Thank you for the call. James in Spring City, Tennessee. Hey, James, what's up?
Good afternoon, Mr. Revere and Mrs. Revere and crew. How are you?
Fine. How are you, James?
I'm hanging in there, sir. Thank you. Defining conservatism, when you look it up on Wikipedia, there are so many different definitions that it's not the way I would label the Koch brothers and this libertarian idea. I think I'd probably rather label it something like terrorist against democracy.
Yeah, now you're devolving into name calling, James.
I know it's kind of harsh. But
it's not just harsh. It's I don't think a lot of people will believe it.
Yeah.
You're saying that, you know, somebody's relative or uncle or boss or whatever is a terrorist. They know that they're not terrorists. They just watch too much Fox News and they think that, you know, what's so isn't so. And I mean, it's I understand what you're saying. I think I do that. You know, democracy is being harmed by their behavior. And I agree with that, but I'm real, particularly in this day of ISIS and Boko Haram, I'm real reluctant to use the word terrorist. But I get your point. James, thank you for the call and for contributing to the conversation. Tim in Asheville, North Carolina, listening on AM 880. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. What's up?
First saw you on The Big Picture, and I was pleased to hear you coming across the local radio waves earlier this year.
Thank you.
I'm listening to you a pretty good amount since. I would like to extend on that kind of definition of conservatism as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I feel like in Asheville, it's particularly easy. It's almost a little microcosm because we have such loud voices from the left and from the right being kind of a liberal pocket in North Carolina. But I think one of the biggest issues that I see just in general is it's almost like we're dividing and conquering ourselves by splitting into these two factions, Republicans and Democrats. And what I see on the ground level, just in talking to people, is that, you know, if you excise the CEOs, you excise the big corporate money, the you and me, the people on the ground, all fairly much want the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but on the other hand, about half of all the money that went into politics in the last election cycle was provided by fewer than 300 people.
Totally. Yeah. And
this is astonishing.
You know, I agree with where you're coming from on it. But I think as a environmentalist, my degree is environmental chemistry, and it's kind of the issue closest to my heart. I spent a lot of time in the woods and mountain biking and things like that. You know, I can't help but realize that all the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, EPA were all started by so-called conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that...
Well, all of those started during the Nixon administration in the early 70s.
Right, yeah, and I guess I'm just getting at the semantics of it itself, like conservative...
But it was Democrats that pushed them through. And Nixon actually vetoed the original EPA Act.
Yeah, so, I guess I didn't realize that, but...
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm saying is just in the spirit of cooperation, or, you know, I sort of feel like we can't, as liberals or as conservatives or whatever, neither of us can be right. It takes everybody. We're all on this thing together.
But see, that's the point, Tim. If you were to ask these conservatives, particularly the wealthy conservatives, are we all in this together? They would say, no, we rich people are in this together. We use the, you know, they use the rich people use the private airports, the private planes, the chauffeured limousines, blah, 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 blah. They've got their concerns. Their concerns are very different than the concerns of people who are using public transportation, people who walk to work, people who drive to work, people who actually have jobs, that pay less than, you know, several hundred thousand dollars a year. I really don't think the conservatives think that we're all in this together. I think that that is a liberal point of view. Tim, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. You know, there's a couple of ways to study the consequences of diet on health. One is called a metabolic ward experiment. It's where you literally lock people up or take sufficient control of their life, you know, that they're not cheating, and feed them in a certain way and then measure their metabolic activity over time. There's actually been a lot of locked ward experiments done that relate to cholesterol over the years, all the way back to 1965, actually. You can get a home cholesterol kit and try this out yourself, in fact. If you eat a stick of butter every day, your cholesterol will go up. It's quite simple. We've known this for 50 years. In fact, if you feed a vegetarian meat just once a day, and these studies go back before the 50s, they were done on Seventh-day Adventists, if you feed a vegetarian meat once a day over a month, their cholesterol will jump 20%. The problem is there's another kind of study that is not what's called an interventional design. In other words, you're not actually intervening in a person's life to study them. You're simply studying populations. It's called a cross-sectional design. And cross-sectional designs don't work well for cholesterol or for diet or for eating, because everybody has a set baseline for how much cholesterol they've got. It's genetically set, plus dietarily and lifestyle. And so by measuring how much somebody's, you know, by doing epidemiological analysis, basically, we've known since the 1970s that when it comes to cholesterol, you get noise, you get, you know, random information. So actually from 1979, we've known that. So what do we do? Well, if you're the Cattlemen's Association or if you're the dairy industry that wants to promote more butter. How about Ronald Krauss? He was funded by the National Dairy Council since 1989. He was also paid by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. You get this guy to pull together a bunch of these observational studies, which have never demonstrated cause and effect between eating fat and having cholesterol, because they can't, because of the way that they're designed. They can't disprove it either. You get a bunch of these studies and do a meta-study of them. He did this in 2010. It was published. It got a lot of fanfare. Hey, fat's good for you. Kind of went away. So they said, hey, it's getting worse. We reboot this thing. So the same guy redid basically the same study in 2014 and said once again, hey, we're not finding anything. As the chair of Harvard's nutrition department put it, he said the conclusions regarding the type of fat being unimportant are seriously misleading and should be disregarded. Well, that said, there are still a lot of folks who want to say, hey, go ahead and eat some fat. Jeff Steyer is on the line with us. He's the director of risk analysis at the National Center for Public Policy Research, nationalcenter.org, a conservative think tank here in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jeff, welcome.
Good to be back with you, Tom.
So tell me, why should we ignore science and go back to eating butter based on this meta study that didn't actually study one single human being?
Well, Tom, I got to hand it to you. It's always fun to listen to you set up the facts in your own way. I would give you a different perspective, unless, of course, you think the American Heart Association is also in the pocket of
on their website the right now. The American Heart Association says the more you can reduce dietary saturated fat, animal fat, the better it'll be for your heart. They're unambiguous.
So they've actually moved away from their recommendations.
They've moved away from the percentage recommendation that they had, but they still are taking the position that the less fat you eat, the less animal fat you eat, the better. And nobody is disputing the fact
that
people who
true.
Eat no not, animal not, fats are actually far less likely to have heart attacks.
And also much angrier. No.
What?
But I think I'm making a joke about people who don't eat animal fats sometimes have a little frustration. But the point here is that the American Heart Association has moved away from these numbers that were saying essentially get almost no fat in your diet, get almost no saturated fat in your diet, 30% fat, and they're moving away from those very strict recommendations. In fact, we have seen over time that there have been, I know you want to do your studies on humans in a lab and put them in a lab and control what they can eat. And that's consistent, I think, from your approach is kind of controlling how everyone lives. But in the real world, people don't live in a lab.
No, but we've actually done those studies, and we found that when people eat animal fat, their cholesterol goes up and the risk of heart attack goes up.
In your world, where you control, where the government...
No, there's a lot of people out there who are vegetarian for religious purposes. The Seventh-day Adventists, for example. Look at the Seventh-day Adventist studies. They have the lowest heart disease rate in the United States. And among the Seventh-day Adventists, the ones who are not just vegetarian, which may mean that they continue to eat cheese and eggs and dairy products, but instead are vegan, have the lowest heart attack rates in the United States, period.
So you could also conclude that being a Seventh-day Adventist is good for you. You can take all of these things and shape them the way you want. But in the real world, there has been
You can't shape these things. They're facts.
Let me tell you some other facts. And I know you don't like sharing facts that don't comport to the conclusion that you want to reach, but please just give me a moment here. Tom, when the government came in and told people on preliminary and not solid evidence that you need to drastically cut the amount of fat in your diet, especially saturated fat, people who were not living in a lab, people who live in the real world, said, oh, okay, if that's what I have to do to stay healthy. And as a result, they did cut their fat intake. But you know what happened? They increased dramatically their carbohydrate intake, and we got heavier and heavier, and that wasn't good for health. Now, what happens is the government loves to jump in based on preliminary...
Wait, hang on just a second, Jeff. You're slightly misstating the facts here. You are right that a lot of Americans moved from a high-fat diet to a high-sugar diet, but it wasn't Americans said, gee, I think I'll eat a less fat and more sugar or more simple carbohydrates. It was that the food companies understand that fat, salt, and sugar is the holy triad, and you've got to have at least two of the three, and they started manufacturing more of these foods that produce obesity, although they may be less horrible in terms of heart disease. I mean, in 1975, the number of people per 100,000 who died of heart disease in the United States was 100 out of 100,000. It was 26% of all deaths in 1975. Today, it's 40 out of 100,000, and it's only 18% of deaths. This is, we've seen a steady decline in the rate of heart disease ever since the government started saying, reduce your fat.
I know you'll take every opportunity you can to blame industry for this, but it's really about the choices that consumers make.
No, it's
industry,
not.
Industry is very...
Choices, consumers choose what's in front of them.
So consumers have plenty of options to buy food that they think is healthier.
Not consumers who are making less than $60,000 a year.
So here's the thing. What they do is they follow the advice. Let me concede a point to you for just a moment. I'm not going to do this on a long-term basis.
Let me
concede a point quickly to you. Let's just say that industry played a role in providing different choices to consumers. Less fat, more carbohydrates, yes, with more sugar in it.
Right.
Consumers follow that.
Right.
Consumers follow that. My advice here on this issue is that the government isn't very good at telling people what to eat.
But
the
McDonald's
outcomes aren't
is worse.
Very good. No, I think consumers are best, and they should speak to their doctors. I think McDonald's, I think the government should all stay out of it, and consumers with their doctors and their family perhaps, should decide how they eat. When the government gets involved in telling us what to do, we have bad outcomes. And I don't think the food industry
that is absolutely not true. There are many areas. I mean, do you want to go back to having medicine men come into town on a wagon and just roll down the back and say, here, buy Dr. Jeff's snake oil?
Well, I think we'd all do a lot better if there were less government and less industry.
Then you're going to have no, but you're not going to have less industry, because the only power that can stand up to industry is government.
I think consumers can.
No, they can't. You try to take on GlaxoSmithKline. You try to take on Yum Foods. How would you do it?
By making choices. And I think by telling people that they have no ability to make choices, I think that message.
Nobody is telling people they have no ability to make choices. Jeff Steyer, hang on to say, Jeff.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Jeff Steyer, Director of Risk Analysis of the National Center for Public Policy Research, website nationalcenter.org. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Tom.
Welcome back. Norma, watching Free Speech TV in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Tom. I was listening to you in the first hour. You were trying to come up with a name for these people who want to rule our world. It made me think back to the Royal Charters and King George, and it made me remember Tennessee Ernie Ford's 16 tons, which is what is happening to Americans today.
Yep.
And I got to thinking, maybe we should call them the new Lords of Royal Charters, or the new Lords of Royal Corporations, the NLRC.
they certainly think of themselves as lords. I mean, it's quite remarkable. I've been at a few events that you can basically only get to, or it's easiest to get to fly in on a private jet, and in these fancy I feel so much like a fish out of water at those things. It's just,
I do too. And I'm a fish out of water here in Montgomery, Alabama. But you could say that the Supreme Court is the minister court, the royal corporations.
Right.
And I don't want to talk bad about somebody who can't defend himself, but Mr. Steyer should try going organic for a year. My doctor loves my blood work. And I went gluten-free, organic, it's almost 2 years now. I've lost weight, and my doctor loves my blood work. And since organic foods are so hard to find, it's like hunting and gathering to find food.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you want to get healthy, organic is the only way to do it, and the more vegetables you eat, the better off you are.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I swore off eating meat when I was 16 years old back in 1967, and largely over the last 3 years or so, and our son made this, who's in his 30s, he became a vegan years ago, but Louise and I have been, I'd say, 99% vegans for several years now.
I will eat fish, but I'm trying. It's very hard to find fish out of the Atlantic because I don't want radiation out of Pacific.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, there's a certain problem with that, and particularly the large ones. But
if you take government control out of the food, there will not be any organic labels on anything. And I've heard rumors that that's what the TPP will do. And
TPP will affect that. But the argument that our last guest was making. Let's take him out of the equation. The meta argument here is if you need information about what you should be eating, who are you going to trust? A giant corporation that makes a profit selling you a particular product and makes less money selling you other products that may be better for you? Or are you going to trust a government agency or government researchers who presumably are working for we the people? And, one of the problems that we have is, now that the Supreme Court has said that corporations can buy politicians, they've also blown up the old revolving door laws. And so now you've got corporations that'll give, well, in the case of Treasury here just last month, this investment bank was going to give this guy $20 million to go away and go work for the Treasury Department to pass laws that would help this bank make more money. Same thing is happening with the USDA and the FDA. These revolving doors, and they're really, really, it's really nasty stuff. So, but, we can clean that up. It's hard. It's much harder to clean up corporations. Norma, thank you for the call. New Royal Charters. Good one. We'll be back with Dr. Michael Greger whose website I quote on the air often, nutritionfacts.org. You might want to get over, check it out, so you can see what's going on here with Dr. Greger. We'll be right back. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, Dr. Michael Greger. He's a physician, an author. He's the director of the Public Health and Animal Agriculture, part of the Humane Society of the United States. His website, nutritionfacts.org. Dr. Greger, welcome.
So happy to be on the show.
It is great to have you with us. Okay, I've got a Daily Mail article here, the headline, Butter Isn't Bad for You After All. Major study says 80s advice on dietary fats was flawed. We just had a fellow on from one of the conservative think tanks here in town saying essentially the same thing. And what say you? I mean, you're one of the leading experts in the world, in my opinion, on the relationship between what we eat and how well we do.
Well, look, there are climate change deniers, vaccine efficacy deniers, evolution deniers, you know, but just because some petroleum-funded scientist questions the scientific consensus about global warming, or a Cattlemen's Association-funded scientist questions saturated fat guidelines from the American Heart Association and Institute of Medicine, you know, doesn't mean there shouldn't be this kind of false equivalency of arguments in the media, and so people end up just not recognizing how out of bounds these notions are from the balance of scientific evidence.
So are you saying that this study is full of beans? No pun intended.
I wish it was full of beans. Unfortunately, it's full of bacon and butter.
Right. Seriously, though, what's wrong with the study that is being touted? I mean, it's on all the morning shows. It's everywhere in America right now.
So this study came out and said that there were no double-blind or any randomized controlled trials showing that Americans should reduce their saturated fat intake before such recommendations came out in the late 70s, early 80s. When you think about it, there's never been a randomized controlled study ever showing that stopping smoking prevents lung cancer. And the reason is, think about that. If you take 1,000 people, you say 1,000 smokers, half you say you have to quit smoking, half say you have to keep smoking for 20 years. And why is that a problem? It's because it's very difficult to stop smoking, so the half you tell to stop smoking probably won't. And it's even perhaps unethical to keep the people smoking for 20 years to see if you can see differences in lung cancer rates. And the same thing with low-fat studies. The studies that were done that randomized people into low-fat or regular fat, the people who were told to go on low-fat never did go on low-fat. And so no wonder that these studies didn't show what we'd expect them to show. But we don't need randomized controlled studies to show that smoking is bad for us, and we don't need randomized controlled studies to tell people that fruits and vegetables are good for us and these processed foods are bad for us.
So what in your opinion, what should our diets be?
Well, the processed and animal foods tend to have more of the things we don't want, like added sugar, cholesterol, saturated fat, sodium, and trans fat. These are so-called nutrients of concern from the federal authorities, and the less of the things that we're not getting enough of as a population. That's fiber, folate, magnesium, potassium, and vitamins A, C, E, and K. And so where are these nutrients of concern found, meaning most Americans aren't getting enough of them? They're found in the most nutrient-dense of foods, and that's whole plant foods. So foods as grown out of the ground, probably the most uncontroversial statement in all of nutrition is eat more fruits and vegetables. Fruits are fruits, and vegetables are basically all the rest of the plant, you know, the stem vegetables, the root vegetables, the leaf vegetables. And so we need to eat more plants in general and get less of the processed junk animal and saturated fat animal foods out of our diet.
Well, what do you say to somebody who says, you know, we evolved as hunter-gatherers. We used to eat animals. We used to hunt animals. Our bodies are optimized for that. Our teeth don't look like a cow's teeth. Cows are herbivores. Therefore, eating a vegetarian or a vegan diet, particularly a vegan diet, no animal products whatsoever, is inconsistent with our physiology.
With our physiology for the last 2 million years, people don't understand human evolution. We first broke with our primate ancestors 25 million years ago in the Miocene epoch, and the Paleo epoch is just the last 2 million years. And so
for the first 90% of our evolution, the first 23 of the last 25 million years, we ate what the rest of the fellow great apes eat, which is almost an exclusive diet of plant foods, centering mostly around fruits and leaves, dark green leafy vegetables. And so that's where our physiology comes from. So we are salt-conserving machines. We are cholesterol-conserving machines because we are so used to get so little on our diet. And just in the last 10% of our evolution did we start adding more of these animal foods to our diet. So really, we were meant to eat these high-fiber, high-plant diets, and what's been happening recently is really the aberration, not the norm.
Is that aberration why we have so much hydrochloric acid in our stomach compared to some of the great apes?
Hydrochloric acid really has very little to do with digestion, mostly to do with food safety. Hydrochloric acid helps us kill the bugs that kind of go into our system. The ruminant animals, like the cows, they have a different digestive system. They actually are able to break down cellulose using these good bugs and these extra stomachs.
It's kind of a fermentation process, rather.
Right, and so that's a little, and so we are actually what are called hind gut fermenters. We don't ferment in the stomach. We ferment in the hind gut, down in the colon, and we're able to break down fiber. People think of fiber as just kind of this kind of Roto-Rooter type sweeping machine, but no, fiber is actually eaten by the good bacteria in our gut, break it up into these short chain fatty acids like butyrate, propionate, have all sorts of wonderful anti-obesity effects and beneficial anti-colon cancer effects. And so, fiber is a vital nutrient, yet 97% of Americans don't even make the recommended daily minimum of fiber intake.
Right, and eating the fiber supplements that are basically ground up wood, the cellulose supplements, is that a good idea?
So unfortunately, our gut bacteria cannot utilize that fiber in the same way. So it may help with constipation, but it doesn't offer the other benefits that the benefits against chronic disease that whole plant foods.
I was fascinated by one of your videos I saw a few weeks ago, or maybe it was a few months ago. I talked about it on the air on the show and credited you for it. That said that if you drank fruit juices, you were at higher risk for obesity. But if you ate the fruit, it was the exact opposite because the fiber in the
–
go ahead.
Yeah, so it's these added sugars, these industrial sugars, the high fructose corn syrup and table sugar that's added to food that does indeed lead to things like increased hypertension, increased fat in the liver, which can cause liver dysfunction. But the same fructose, the same sugars in whole plant foods has the opposite effect, actually decreases our risk of chronic disease. We should eat foods the way we were designed to eat them whole.
Sir, you are a genius. Dr. Michael Greger, physician, author, director of public health and animal agriculture for the Humane Society, his website, nutritionfacts.org. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Greger.
Honored to be here.
Great talking to you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So I still ain't eating butter. See you. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Trista Hendren, writing over at thegoodgirl.com, made just a remarkable comment that has been turned into one of those Facebook video or visual images and is reposted right now over at Democratic Underground. The misrepresentation of God as strictly male has wounded women in every area of their lives, she says. Females are raped, abused, molested, trafficked, and prostituted because of the desires of men, a.k.a. God, are prioritized over the emotional, physical, psychological, and spiritual needs of women and girls. The exclusive image of God as male ensures that women and girls will always be considered last. If you read Leonard Schlain's book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, and, unfortunately, Leonard's no longer with us. He died of a brain tumor. Ironically, he was a brain surgeon, literally a brain surgeon. I knew Leonard Schlain somewhat. I had a couple of meals with him. We had some very, very interesting conversations and correspondences. And in his book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, he talks about how it was principally the goddess in Europe up until the time that Gutenberg came along, up until the invention of the printing press, that was worshipped. Rather than Jesus, it was Mary. The Catholics of Europe were a woman-honoring prior to the printing press. And within a generation or two of widespread literacy moving across Europe, you saw women being hanged and burned to death as witches, and this whole, they tore down the Mary shrines, replaced them with Jesus shrines, and God went from being female to male again. And it's a whole fascinating thing. I realize it's got nothing to do with corporate fascism or butter, but I thought it was, you know, something I wanted to share with you. Joni Ernst, back to women. You know, I really think more women in politics would be a good thing. I'm not sure, though, that it's always a good thing, and I think Margaret Thatcher is probably the poster child for that. But here's Joni Ernst, the woman whose family took $460,000 in government supports for farmers can get this free money from the government for growing or not growing certain things. Joni Ernst's family took almost $500,000. And this is what she said about poor people in the United States. What we have to do a better job of is educating not only Iowans, but the American people that they can be self-reliant, self-sufficient. They don't have to rely on the government to be the do-all, end-all for everything they need and desire. And that's what we have fostered, is really a generation of people that rely on the government, it should be who, rely on the government to provide absolutely everything for them. It's going to take a lot of education to get people out of that. It's going to be very painful, and we know that. Really? Painful? In other words, you want to like just cut people off? It's going to be painful, and we know that. So do we have the intestinal fortitude to do that? Question mark. And she goes on to say, we're looking at Obamacare right now. Once we start those benefits in January, she said this about a year ago, how are we going to get people off of those? It's exponentially harder to remove people once they've already been on the program. We rely on government for absolutely everything. Well, no, that's a wild exaggeration. I've never bought a car from government. I've never bought a meal from government. Actually, when I was 6 or 7 years old, when my family, when Dad was selling encyclopedias door to door, we used to get government surplus cheese. In any case, Joni Ernst. And in the years since I was a small girl up until now into my adulthood with children of my own, we have lost a reliance on not only our own families, but so much of what our churches and private organizations used to do. They used to have wonderful food pantries. They used to provide clothing for those who really needed it. We've gotten away from that. Now we're at the point where the government will give just about anything away. Joni, hate to burst your bubble, but the food pantries are still there. And to the tune of about $5 billion a year worth of giving away things. And the Salvation Armies and all those other the secondhand stores and whatnot, they're still there. And they're not enough, because the rules of capitalism were changed during this thing called Reaganomics to favor big corporations and rich people and to disfavor working people, to move our jobs overseas, to bring profits back to the United States and to financialize industry so that, you know, the captains of industry are sitting around trying to figure out how to jack up their share prices so they can take a larger chunk of money when they cash in their stock options. They're far more concerned with that than how to manufacture a new product that's going to stimulate the economy and produce jobs in the United States. It's a real tragedy. And then we get the lectures about morality, about the morality of taking things from government, from someone whose family took $460,000 from the government. It's bizarre. Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, what's on your mind?
Yes, Tom. I think that the most important thing is to win back the Senate, the House Representatives, and the White House in 2016.
I think there's a very good chance. In fact, I think it's probable the Democrats will take back the Senate. It's unlikely they'll take the House. And the White House is...
I have an idea that I think will guarantee it.
What's that?
This is my idea that everybody running for the Senate or for the House be on board with this idea, is that the first $30,000 of your income for the poor be tax-free. If you have a child, then the first $40,000 of your income is tax-free. Now, Ronald Reagan could care less. What happened to the our country when he cut taxes on the rich? So why the hell should we be worried? Let them figure out what to do, We've got to help the poor and the middle class, and I think my idea would catch on all across the country, and we can get the House of Representatives back with the Senate.
But the people making under $30,000 are probably, I don't know the exact numbers and where the trend line would fall, but I would guess they're probably paying somewhere between a third and a half of the total cost of Social Security and Medicare. Because the payroll tax
I understand.
After $118,000, you don't pay into payroll tax anymore. So
But I think what I'm trying to say is that the idea is very simple, and the whole idea is to win back the House and the Senate.
Yeah, yeah. I absolutely agree with you, Howard. And as time goes on, we need to be more involved with that, not less. And please get active and show up at your local Democratic headquarters, and we can do this. Howard, thank you for the call. Len in Cedarhurst, New York. Hey, Len, what's on your mind today?
Hi, that was a perfect segue. My head's been exploding the last day and a half after having, conversations with right-wingers who just don't know enough to have a conversation with, and then having the opportunity to hear Newt Gingrich, on C-SPAN early yesterday morning without at least someone else questioning what he's saying. And really, my question is, I've had a conversation with the person who answered the phone. Just in terms, maybe you can fill us all in with what the boundaries are to your show in supporting Bernie Sanders should he run for president.
Bernie's campaign website is bernie.org. His official government website is sanders.senate.gov. I don't mention his campaign website when he's on the show, just out of an excessive caution. I don't want to appear to be partisan or whatever, but he's not on the show today. He's got nothing to do with the show. If you're interested in Bernie's campaign website, it's bernie.org.
Right.
And presumably that would be where you could communicate with him or donate to him or whatever to help in his decision to run for president.
You were mentioning before, how many people listen to your show every week, roughly?
It's hard to know for sure, but according to Talkers Magazine, I think the number was 2.5 million was the last time that they tried to measure us.
Let me just because he's not on the show, I can pose these questions. Presumably, if 2 million people, let's assume that 95% agree, because I feel like I'm in either one echo chamber or another these days.
Right.
So let's assume that 95%, say roughly 2 million people, agree with him. Some kind of mail campaign where everyone sent in simply a postcard, to Got Your Back Bernie and promised to get 10 more people involved. I mean, I don't know to what extent that this is the place, but I can't imagine a better place. So there being some unofficial demarcation of where you can find out what he's talking about and who he's arguing with.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that all the information about when and where Bernie is speaking and what he's talking about and all that kind of stuff you can find at sanders.senate.gov. And, beyond that, I'd say, contact him if you want to support his candidacy. I certainly do. I think Bernie Sanders would make a wonderful contribution to the Democratic primary. If you want to support his candidacy, bernie.org or sanders.senate.gov. Len, I think, thank you for the call. Your point that, a lot of us saying run Bernie run is a great start. The thing that I am guessing the thing that I would be struggling with if I was Bernie, and I was running for political law, and I was thinking of running for president, is the fact that it takes about $1 billion to become president. And it might take this coming election, it might take $2 billion. It might even take $3 or $4 billion. And the question is, where do you get that money? Let's say there's 2 million people listening right now and everybody gave $10. That's $20 million. That doesn't even get you in the door. You gotta have $80 to $100 million just to get into a primary debate. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is one of the reasons why, Senator Sanders is so aggressive about, public funding of elections. A moment. Welcome back. Corky in Rochester, New York, watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind, Corky?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, they might as well set up an ISIL employment office over there in Europe, you know, Germany and all the countries that the right-wingers are clamping down, and they're not providing, you know, social safety nets. Because what does a young man do?
Right.
He's got no jobs. ISIL's offering employment.
Right.
And you think you're going to win this war?
Right. They're not just offering employment. They're saying, you know, come to the Middle East. We'll provide you with a job. We'll provide you with food. We'll provide you with housing. And we'll give you a wife. And if we can't get you a wife, there's lots and lots of women that we're going to encounter who you can just rape all you want.
Yeah, and they're going to give them medical insurance, too.
Right.
They're going to give them care. Now, how do you beat back an idea like that when you're coming up with these right-wing policies where you want to take the people and clamp them down? You're not going to give them anything. And it's the same in this country. They're saying, look, you're out of work. I'm offering you $2 an hour. I don't care what the cost of living is. You'll work for the $2 an hour or you ain't going to eat.
Mm-hmm.
What does that do to a man when he can't even provide for his family? That turns him into a terrorist.
Yeah, I mean, either people respond typically with despair, depression, or with anger and outrage, particularly when they realize that it's not their fault and that the game has been rigged for the benefit of very wealthy people. I'm with you, Corky, and we've got some serious problems here. Thanks a lot for the call. Mina in central Nebraska watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Mina, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I'm calling to disagree with you, which I don't do that often. My doctor, I have what's called chemical sensitivities, and my doctor, who's one of the best three in the nation, recommended a book to me by Udo Aramis called Fats That Heal and Fats That Kill.
Right.
And he says that butter is better for you than margarine because margarine is all made with chemicals. Anything that's hydrogenated, they're using a chemical process and putting chemicals in the product.
Right. But it's not a binary choice, Mina. You know, back when I used to eat bread, I used olive oil as an alternative to butter, and that's not hydrogenated. You can just dip your bread in olive oil. I mean, that's how they do it in the Middle East. In the Mediterranean.
Yep. We use olive oil, and I was using safflower oil for baking, and I'm having a little bit of trouble getting it now.
Yeah. But I don't disagree that, you know, it's not about fats. It's about what are the bad fats. And hydrogenated fats are terrible. They're saturated fats. They're artificially made saturated fats. And the old margarine, some of the old margarines were really, really bad for you. In fact, some of them were full of trans fats. And those are now, you know, basically banned. But that said, I think that there are some spreadable things that sort of taste and smell like butter that might be healthy. I don't know. We should ask Dr. Greger.
One thing, my mother has Alzheimer's, and what we're using is coconut oil.
Dr. Greger has a really interesting video on his site at nutritionfacts.org about Alzheimer's and turmeric. You might want to check it out, man. It's, you know, my mom died from Alzheimer's. I've started taking turmeric. I'm like, oh. Mina, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a little personal bragging. This is, or whatever. I'm just telling you the story. Some things out of my life. By the way, our Louise's new dog, Blue, who has one blue eye and one brown eye, he's doing fine. He's up to 8 pounds now. He's going to get to 20. And he's really a smart dog. And Fang has just figured out that he can just, like, ignore the dog, or if the dog gets too close, can whack him. Wolfie, I call him Stinky. Wolfie is still scared to death of the dog, and he gets all fluffed up, but he's getting more and more curious. And Mowgli just lays around, waits for the dog to get near him, and then just whacks him in the face. So anyhow, that's what's going on there. But the other thing that I want to tell you about is my mom, when we were growing up, was really interested in our genealogy and her family's in particular. She never really looked into my dad's family. His grandparents came here from Norway. but she was fascinated by her own family's genealogy, and which extended back to the 1600s. And she had been trying to get into the Daughters of the American Revolution so that her children and grandchildren could be members of the Sons of the American Revolution and the Daughters of the American Revolution, which was just like really important to her. And one of her dying thing wishes to me was, it wasn't literally a dying wish, but she just said many, many times over her life, once she was still lucid, would you please finish this research? Because she spent 20 years doing it. And this was before there was Ancestry.com kind of stuff around there. And, I mean, we traveled all over the country trying to track down mom's relatives. And so over the last couple of years, I have done that with the help of a genealogist and got it all together and sent in my application to Sons of the American Revolution, and they approved me on the 6th of February. So I'm a member of Sons of the American Revolution. Isn't that cool? Which means that I had a relative who fought in the American Revolution. And it also means that now our kid, you know, Louise and my kids are eligible for all this. So it's kind of an all-American thing, isn't it? I don't know. Maybe I'm just, I guess I'm just bragging. Sorry about that. Kenneth in Parrington, Michigan. Hey, Kenneth, what's up?
Hey there, Blue Coat. How you doing?
Blue Coat. There you go. I'm fine. How are you, Kenneth?
Yes. I just wanted to call and thank you for inspiring me to get active. I am going to my first Democratic Party meeting tonight.
Oh, great.
We're going to see where they're at and see if we can't start pushing to the left and get more back where we were back in the 60s and 70s. And for a state like Michigan to be where it's at right now just appalls me.
Yeah, I agree. Kenneth, let me break our one call a week rule here. If you want to give us a call back tomorrow or anytime throughout the rest of the week and let us know how that meeting went, I'd love to hear the report.
You betcha, because if they haven't heard a progressive before, they're going to hear one tonight.
Okay. Well, good luck, Kenneth, and thank you for the call. Thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV, and I look forward to talking to you later this week, okay?
Yeah, you got it, Doug.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Good talking with you. Linda in Chicago. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind tonight?
Hi, Tom. I hope that you don't think this idea is too simplistic, but I'd like to know what you think.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you say Democrat, how about always coupling it with the Democrats, the economically the party of the working middle class? And whenever you say Republican, you couple it every time with Republicans, economically the party of the super rich. Until it becomes a habit and of always putting these words together, because I have too many middle class working friends that I can't get through to think they are Republicans because their parents were Republicans,
right,
and don't realize the term Republican has the name has been changed and has been redefined, and they need to be educated. And as long as they're not educated, the Republicans can continue to fool them because it's cloaked in there. You don't know what it really means. They don't know what they're...
Here's what Harry Truman said about Republicans, and it's just apropos of what you're saying, Linda. Check this out.
The people know the Democratic Party is the people's party, and the Republican Party is the party of special interest, and it always has been and always will be.
There we go. We need more truth-telling Democratic presidents, I think. But,
yeah,
Linda, I think that's a great suggestion.
Well, I think the terms, the working middle class and the term super rich, that you got to be really simplistic, because if people don't identify with it, then it doesn't get through.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you very much, Linda. I appreciate the call. Jim in Custer, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to talk a little bit about Jordy Ernst, hog castrator of the world.
Right.
When I was a kid growing up on a farm, there were many castration ceremonies, and the idea was that the animal would not be into sex anymore, but it would be about food, and it would grow much bigger.
Right.
Jordy says that she'll be able to cut pork because of her abilities at castrating. Well, that will just make the pork grow even bigger, and you have illustrated that by showing the pork that her family gets from the government.
Yeah. Yeah, she could have castrated some of that $460,000. Well, actually, probably had paid for some of the pigs that she castrated, so.
Yeah,
so interesting really, point, though. Interesting point that her analogy is upside down. Only somebody who's a farmer who has been around farmers would realize that castrating an animal, neutering a male animal causes them to become more sedentary and thus more prone to gain weight. I mean, that's
exactly. I think a lot of people do. They'll get a cat fixed, and then the cat suddenly becomes a doorstop instead of going out looking right. for trouble and so forth.
Been there, done that. Yeah.
I was glad to hear that there's another fellow from Michigan interested in pushing things a little bit left, because to have all three legs of this Michigan government be Republican, it feels like you're living in some kind of repressed area.
Well, you're living in a state that has been taken over by and large by the DeVos family, you know, by some very, very wealthy Republicans out of the Grand Rapids area. And in the Holland area, and it's really astonishing what Rick Snyder has done. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Keep the faith there in Michigan. Great to hear from you. And thanks for the little reality check on Joni Ernst. That's fascinating. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires all of us to show up. So get out there and get to your local Democratic Party meeting. The clock is ticking. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.